It's obvious by now that the war in Ukraine has disrupted many aspects of the world economy. But the war has also shone some light on another force at play.
We are witnessing the emergence of, you know, the rise of emerging market economies. And as their weight increases, some reorganization of the way the world, the economic world is structured, the political world is structured, is bound to happen. And we're witnessing some of that.
Today, we ask IMF chief economist Pierre-Olivier Gourinchat what the rising power of emerging market economies might mean for the importance of the U.S. dollar in the international monetary and financial system.
It's not going to undermine the dominance of the dollar in relative terms, but it might lead countries to rethink their accumulation of dollar reserves a little bit.
Pierre-Olivier Gourinchat published an article on shifting geopolitical tectonic plates in the latest Finance and Development magazine and spoke to me from France, where he began his distinguished career in economics. So economics is so ingrained in our daily lives, we can't really ignore it, but I'm always interested in hearing what motivates people to pursue a career in it. Was there a moment in your youth where you said, you know, this is for me, or was it more subtle than that?
Well, I guess I was in college in France, and I was coming from the science track, so I was studying to become a physicist.
Wow.
And but I always had some sort of some interest in social sciences, and I decided to take a few courses in economics, and then I had the but it was more sort of I was thinking of it as general culture, not necessarily something I would do professionally. Hmm. But then I had the opportunity to do a research internship in research department of one of the French institutions. And that was really a fascinating experience for me because I came in and they gave me a topic to work on, and I had to read some of the frontier research and try to make sense of it all. And I was just, you know, I was 22-year-old, and I really this was all news to me, and I was this whole process of research, especially working on what I felt was sort of working on the real world, that I found this was fascinating. So that's when you know, I got the bug in a sense, and it never sort of left me after that. Mm.
And so you work on, I mean, now, obviously, you work on a lot of different aspects in the field, but your work on dominant reserve currencies has gained a lot of attention, especially recently, given the relevance of that today. And, you know, we'll get into that shortly. But why dominant reserve currencies?
Well, this is a research agenda that started a long time ago for me. I was a young assistant professor at Princeton University, and I started working with, we had just hired this brilliant young economist, Hélène Rey, who is, of course, very famous by now. She's at London Business School. And we started working together, and we got very interested in this question of how countries basically can repay their external debt, or, you know, do they need to generate trade surpluses at some point in the future, or how does it work exactly? And from a very practical point of view, we wanted to sort of study that. And then when we looked a little bit more carefully, we realized that there was something very special about the U.S. in that it seemed to be able to run trade deficits year after year, and sizable trade deficits. And yet, at the end of the day, it wasn't accumulating external debt. Its net foreign asset position wasn't changing very much, or it was even in fact improving. It was not becoming worse. And we started looking into that more carefully, and then we realized there was something really interesting happening, and it had to do with the position of the dollar in the international monetary system, and the way this would provide some sort of insurance to other countries and generate some sort of premium for the issuer of the sort of the international reserve asset, the United States. And so that got us to, you know, over a series of papers, got us to think about the way the international monetary system is organized, and is organized around a few key currencies. And the US dollar is, of course, the first and most important one of those. Mm. And so we were fascinated by this question of trying to understand how we came up with, how the system organized itself in this sort of very structured way with the dollar and dollar assets at the center.
How interesting. And so in this article that you've written recently for Finance and Development, you use an earthquake as a metaphor to describe the geopolitical landscape out there these days. Why an earthquake?
Well, the metaphor of the earthquake came, maybe this is, I'm showing my California roots here. I've been spent 20 plus years in Northern California and not very far from some of the earthquake fault lines. But it was pretty clear immediately after the Russian invasion of Ukraine started that the impact would sort of have this gradient. It would be this tremendous impact, of course, in the conflict areas, Ukraine first and foremost, and then through the sanctions, Russia itself. And as we were doing our projections for the April WEO, we realized that the downward revision for these two countries were massive. And then you had this sort of spillovers and through a number of channels, and they were hitting first and foremost the neighboring countries, refugees and the trade relations and remittances and factors like this. And then there were the effects that were sort of more impervious to distance or through commodity markets. And so this idea of something like an earthquake sort of emerged very naturally in that context.
Mm-hmm. And so, you go on to describe how these tectonic plates, geographic and political, are moving or separating from each other. What does all that mean in the context of today's economy?
Yeah, so I'm glad you bring the tectonic plate aspect. I mean, in a sense, we realized that the metaphor had actually won deeper interpretation in a sense, because beyond just the epicenter and the direct impact, I mean, modern theory about earthquakes says that it's about the underlying continental plates that are sort of shifting and drifting and causing these things. And here, there was a parallel with what we are seeing. I mean, it's very clear that there is a sort of a Western bloc, and Western in the broad sense, including countries like Japan and a set of mostly advanced economies, but not only that, we're very very opposed to what was happening, and then there was of course Russia and maybe a few countries that aligned themselves with Russia, and then a lot of other countries that were sort of in the middle, some of them maybe closer to Russia, some of them closer to the say the G7 countries. And so it suggested that there was also potential for blocks or this geopolitical tectonic plates, if you want, sort of to reemerge. But the deeper point there was that, these forces were at play even before the onset of the war. And that's one of the points that I tried to convey in the Finance and Development piece, is this idea that we are witnessing the emergence of, the rise of emerging market economies. And as the weight of economic weight, the financial weight, or political weight, increases, some reorganization of the way the world, the economic world is structured, the political world is structured, is bound to happen. And we're witnessing some of that. And the danger here is that we could decide that we get into this opposition where these different blocks start moving away and not cooperating with each other.
So a lot of different things had to come together, like building trust between countries and trade relations and political alliances to build what we refer today as globalization. Do you think we're now seeing the end of that process?
Well, it's very likely it will have to evolve. The globalization process we had gave rise to the configuration that we have now. I mean, in a sense, this rise of emerging market was powered and was facilitated by the fact that we had a increasingly globally integrated world that allowed these countries to really tap into world growth. It may very well have to change in the sense that, as I described earlier, it will have to become a multilateral world more than a a unipolar world, one that has, you know, the U.S. as a sort of a dominant force. And the question then becomes, how do we manage this transition? And you could imagine two types of transitions. You could have a transition where we have, you know, this one extreme, the emergence of these blocs, and these blocs are sort of self-contained entities. They are not trading, or they are not cooperating. They are not engaging in technology exchange with other blocs, trading within themselves. And each of these blocs is going to have an architecture with maybe a dominant currency within it, and it will be relatively stable, and the relative sizes will be fairly constant. But each of these blocks will not achieve, and collectively they will not achieve the same kind of efficiency gains and collective governance we need on common issues we're facing. And so that will be a world that will be less efficient, poorer world, a more costly world, and a more vulnerable world. But that's not the only possibility. We can also think about a world that remains multipolar, but where we have ways of engaging across the aisle, across the globe, in terms of common goods that we need to make progress on, whether it's climate change or pandemic preparedness or securing energy security for everyone, and digital currencies, and the need to, which is sort of as aspect of a common good as well, and think about ways in which we want to organize their emergence. And it's a more complicated world, but it's also one that promises to be more efficient and to achieve higher standards of living for all. So that's the task that's ahead of us. An institution like the fund, this is sort of the work we have to engage in, is to make sure that we maintain these lines of dialogue, that we maintain this this communication, that we maintain this engagement, even if we have countries that are not necessarily talking to each other much sometimes.
So if we do manage to get, if the world manages to get through this period and not drift apart in these geopolitical tectonic plates, as you describe them, does that mean, do you think that the dollar will also maintain its status as the dominant reserve currency in the world?
It will probably have to evolve, although the timeline on this is probably, I mean, I don't want to say it's the same time scale as, as continental drift, but it's fairly slow. And so what I mean by this is that, you know, if we were to look down the road 20, 30, 50 years, I think it would be a reasonable prediction to expect that somehow there is more than one dominant currency. And but the number of steps that we would have to implement to get there, and to get there in sort of a smooth fashion, are actually quite numerous. And so nothing is going to happen anytime soon. What might be happening in the near future is, if you think about, for instance, the desirability of dollar reserve accumulation by countries. Well, clearly, you know, if you think that countries are holding dollar reserves in part, it's not the only reason, but in part because it's a form of insurance, it's a form of safe asset that they want to be holding. And there are sound arguments that this is behind part of the reserve accumulation that many countries are doing. Certainly the fact that, you know, there's been some degree of arbitrariness that has been injected in the system, with the possibility that, you know, these reserves might be frozen by the decisions of, you know, U.S. authorities, and, you know, seen from the perspective of those countries accumulating those reserves, those decisions might seem arbitrary. So that reduces the usefulness of reserves, and it doesn't mean that there is an alternative out there. I mean, there isn't really. At scale, there isn't really anything that is would all of a sudden be relatively safer than the U.S. dollar. It's just that safety is not an absolute concept. It's a relative concept. And the fact that dollar reserves may seem as being slightly less safe doesn't mean that everything else is somehow safer relatively. It might not be the case. But it might lead countries to rethink the overall amount of self-insurance they want to do. So we might see less accumulation of reserves. Reserves right now are one of the primary ways in which countries can try to fend off external shocks that they're facing. And the global financial safety net, something that we measure at the fund, you know, about $13 trillion of that global financial safety net, which might be something of the order of $18 to $20 trillion overall, but 13 of that is in the form of international reserves. The IMF resources themselves are about $1 trillion. And so if you have a reduction in that amount of reserves, countries decide that, you know, that insurance is not really desirable any longer or not to the same extent, then we'll have less insurance potentially. Means countries might be more vulnerable. So that's one of the short-run aspects that we might see. So it's not going to undermine and reduce the dominance of the dollar in relative terms, but it might lead countries to rethink their accumulation of dollar reserves a little bit. Hmm.
So you spoke of your work with Ellen Ray at the beginning of this interview, where you collaborated on research of dominant reserve currencies, notably the dollar, work that ultimately came to be associated with what's known as the Triffin dilemma. And you speak in this article about how you see a kind of geopolitical Triffin dilemma emerging now. So maybe just briefly explain the Triffin dilemma and how it fits into the geopolitics.
Well, the original Triffin dilemma goes back to the Bretton Woods period when Bob Triffin was a distinguished economist at Yale, observed that, you know, if the U.S. was going to be pegged to gold and all the other countries were pegged to the dollar, then, you know, as the world economy was growing, there would be more demand for dollars. So countries would want to accumulate dollars. But of course, the U.S. could provide these dollars, but if it was supposed to be pegged to gold, then at some point it may not have enough gold to backstop the entire dollar issuances. And it was a dilemma because in order to maintain sort of a dollar money supply that would be tied to gold, it would have to be very contractionary in a sense. It would have to refuse to expand the dollar supply, and that would be contractionary for the world. So that was sort of the dilemma at the time. Ellen Ray and I, when we started working on these issues in 2005, and we started noticing that there is this still to this day, this organic dominance of the dollar in the international monetary and financial system, we asked ourselves, well, is there a form of the Triffin dilemma that survives? I mean, that was pointed out by Triffin in the 1960s, and Triffin conjectured that as a result, there would be a point at which, you know, maybe there would be a run on the dollar. I mean, he was vindicated, of course, the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. That was a run on the dollar by countries that all of a sudden didn't trust that their dollar reserves were equivalent to the gold equivalent. And they were right. There was not enough gold. And the way we're thinking about this, we're saying, well, you know, if countries want dollar assets as safe assets, well, what is the backing now? Of course, it's not gold, but it, in a sense, it's the powers of taxation of the U.S. government. I mean, when you're holding U.S. Treasury bills, you're expecting that they will be repaid in full, and somehow you're expecting somehow the U.S. government is going to be issuing debt that is sustainable. But then if the world is growing very fast, if, you know, the emerging market economies are growing at 10% a year, like China did for many years, and they want to accumulate part of their wealth in U.S. Treasuries, it's going to be a tremendous demand for U.S. Treasuries. So there will be tremendous appetite around the world. The U.S. might satisfy this demand. We'll be able to issue that very cheaply at very low interest rates. But then it might get to a point where it exceeds its fiscal capacity. So that's the equivalent of the Triffin dilemma and sort of the new Triffin dilemma. And when we reach that point, then maybe at that point, the U.S. treasuries or the U.S. dollar assets are not safe assets anymore. And so that's the Triffin moment, if you want. Now, the geopolitical aspect of the Triffin dilemma, if you want, was to sort of say, well, in order to maintain, let's say, a global economy that, you know, is rules-based, the U.S., given its dominant position, may feel that it has to sort of set some rules. And as part of these rules, it may decide that it wants to impose some sanctions on countries when, as seen at least from its perspective, it is legitimate from the U.S. point of view. But in doing so, it also undermines the demand for the demand for dollar assets, and more generally, because what makes the sanctions a very powerful weapon right now is not just the fact that countries are holding you know, the Central Bank of Russia is holding U.S. treasuries, but it's also that most financial institutions are using the U.S. dollar as part of their transaction, as a vehicle currency, as a not just as a reserve currency. They're all plugged into the dollar financial system. And so the sanctions imposed by the U.S. government unilaterally can reach very, very far outside the U.S. borders through the financial system, and the fact that a lot of this financial system is dollar-based. But by the same token, the moment you start, you know, using those tools to achieve some goals, then they might undermine the desirability of some of these dollar assets or the use of the dollar as an international currency. And so it might precipitate a sort of Triffin moment where countries are moving away. Although, as we discussed earlier, it's not that this would be an immediate transition, but it certainly weakens eventually the position of the dollar.
So what does all of this mean anyway? I mean, in terms of, you know, what we're describing here is essentially fragmentation, and the IMF has talked a lot about being worried about fragmentation. What does it mean for multilateralism generally and for the IMF in particular, which is, in fact, all about integration? I mean, that's what the institution does.
But it is it is the very DNA of the institution. I mean, it was really set up to reduce financial vulnerabilities and, you know, promote financial stability, but that requires multilateralism. So it's a clear issue for us. And I think, as I described earlier, you could imagine if the world were to become a totally fragmented world, if we have, a return to something that would look like, you know, a modern version of the Cold War with different blocks that are not talking to each other or on a very limited basis, then that would make it very, very difficult for the fund. The fund would effectively, you know, potentially have to be in one of those blocks, and then that's it, the way it was back in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. I think the work agenda for the fund is therefore to try to do all it can to prevent that. That would be a disastrous outcome for the world economy. And I think the way to do this is to work on multiple fronts. One is to make sure that we promote multilateral conversations on the common good items, whether we think about, as I mentioned, climate transition is one of them. Financial stability, of course, is still one of them. I mean, preventing, debt crisis or preventing financial meltdowns is something that we are still very much in a world where we're all interconnected in very deep ways. And so the fund has a role to play in all of this. I think for the reasons I just described, the fact that there might be a diminished desire for dollar asset accumulation, dollar reserve assets accumulation, and therefore a shrinking global financial safety net, you might imagine that creates also a space for the fund to be a little bit more creative and coming in with alternative solutions that would allow for the emergence of this multipolar world. We can have the multilateralism with the multipolar world, in other words, in terms of the funding instruments, in terms of the ways in which we address financial crisis or balance of payments problems or self-insurance needs of countries. And so I think it's both a difficult period for the fund potentially, but it's also one where there are new perspectives that are opening because the world is changing in a profound way. And so we have to think about how we can help build the needed bridges, if you want, to keep countries sort of at the table.
So with the challenges come opportunities.
As is often the case.
Pierre-Olivier Gorinchat, IMF Chief Economist, thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Pierre-Olivier Gorinchat is the IMF's Economic Counselor and Director of the Research Department. You can read his article on shifting geopolitical tectonic plates in the June issue of Finance and Development. Check it out at imf.org/FND. And look for other IMF podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.